This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
After decades of great science showing how climate change operates, we get an incoming American administration composed of climate science deniers. How is that possible? A listener suggested I contact Ajit Varkey about his book Denial, Self-Deception, False Beliefs, and the Origins of the Human Mind. So now we're in for a treat. We'll spend a little time with an awe-inspiring professor of medicine and pioneer researcher from the University of California in San Diego. Following his beginning in India, Ajit Varkey has led American explorations into cellular and molecular medicine. His multifaceted mind also ventures into the origins of humans and, as it turns out, a critical mechanism of human consciousness. Understand the role of denial, says Varkey, and you understand a lot about your own life and the civilization around us. Ajit Varkey, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Your meeting with Danny Brower and this book on denial shows to me that advances can be almost accidental or serendipitous at least. Tell us about Danny Brower.
Yeah, that's really a case of serendipity in science. I, as you mentioned, mostly study cellular and molecular medicine and cellular and molecular differences between humans and other species. But once in a while, I venture into sort of less familiar territory such as psychology and so on. And when you do that, you're guaranteed somebody will come and give them your opinion, their opinion. You know, everybody has an opinion about the human mind. And so I sat down for lunch at the University of Arizona in 2005 after giving a lecture, and this bearded man sat next to me and said, "You're all asking the wrong question." And then I realized he was the chair of cell biology, Danny Brower, and he gave me this fascinating idea. I'd never thought about it before. And I suggested to Danny that he should write this up, and we sat there for an hour and a half after everybody's gone talking about it. But then I never heard from him again. And then a year later, I tried to contact him, still got no response, and I finally looked him up on the internet and found his obituary. And so not knowing what to do, since he had not published his basic idea, I wrote a letter to the journal Nature along with my own embellishments of his idea and extensions. And that was published in 2009, I believe. And shortly thereafter, I was contacted by his widow, who said, Sharon Brower, who said, "Thank you so much. Can you please finish Danny's book?" And so I ended up with Danny's incomplete manuscript and done something I'd never done before, write a book with a man I'd met only for an hour and a half and who's no longer with us.
That is amazing. Well, let's get to the essential theory that you and Danny propose. Why do we humans need denial as a function of our intelligence?
So let's step back and acknowledge, I think you will, everybody will, it's not just climate change. We deny anything we don't like, you know. I study the mechanism by which red meat increases the risk of cancer and heart attacks, and yet 80% of the people in my lab eat red meat. And we could go on and on, right, whether it be exercise, national debt, different levels of denial, but we're all in some form of denial or the other. So it's a very peculiar human characteristic, and it's never really been explained. There are many discussions about this, you know, different names for it, cognitive dissonance, other kinds of words used in different books written about this general phenomenon. But why would we end up with something like that? And that was the question that Danny approached in a new way. And the basic question he asked was something that I'd never thought about. You know, people like me have been looking for a long time to say, what made us human? What was that cognitive leap, or what were the series of genetic and biological changes that made it possible for us to, say, you know, run a radio station or whatever? And when you think about that, you assume that it was just natural selection gradually, you know, selecting for an improved mind. And Danny said you should not be asking that question. We've got birds, we've got elephants, we've got dolphins, we've got whales, we've got chimpanzees. I just described 200 million years or more of evolution where we had many, many smart, warm-blooded, social, complex intelligent creatures. So he said you should not be asking what made us human. You should be asking what stopped everybody else. Why aren't we competing with a human-like elephant or a human-like dolphin or a human-like crow? Why is just one of us, was one species, taking over the planet? So that was the sort of counterintuitive idea he put in my head, which I'd never heard before.
And what is that barrier? I mean, what happened? It sounds from my reading of your book that a double leap happened.
Right. So after thinking about it further, and I realized that I coined a term in the book, a psychological evolutionary barrier. So we've all heard of physiological evolutionary barriers. For example, going from water to land, that's not easy and wasn't done many times. And you can't just, you know, walk out onto land and start living. You've got to have many things work just right. So it's a barrier. And there have been many such barriers in evolution that have been surpassed by complex processes of evolution. But when you have a barrier, many things have to go just right at the right time in order to break the barrier, as opposed to just gradual, you know, improvement by natural selection. So this psychological evolutionary barrier that Danny was positing has to do with something. We must begin with self-awareness. Now, all of the species I just mentioned, crows, corvid birds, elephants, dolphins, etc., can recognize themselves in a mirror. This kind of study has been done to varying extents, most convincingly in chimpanzees. They know who they are, just as we know who we are. So they would be like a 2 to 3 year old child who can recognize himself or herself in the mirror. So that's pretty close to where we are, after all. And more recently, it's been shown that they even begin to understand the minds of others. But this is the critical step. We not only understand the minds of ourselves, we understand the minds of others, and we can put ourselves in the mental shoes of others. So right now, I'm sitting at one end of a telephone talking to you who I have not met in person. You're listening to me and understanding what I'm saying. And if and when you broadcast this, a whole bunch of people across the world will understand what I said on this telephone. So that is called something called, many words for it, it's called extended theory of mind would be the best word, the technical term. So in other words, you have a theory of my mind, I have a theory of your mind, I have a theory of the minds of your potential listeners. So when I'm speaking, I'm thinking about that, right? And all the other animals, all the chimpanzees were recently shown to be able to, and actually birds some time ago, to sort of understand the minds of others, fail at this extreme degree of extended theory of mind. And so that's the other conundrum that Danny, in a way, was positing. He was starting with self-awareness, but I developed it further in this manner. So you would think that this should be a good thing, right? Because we've taken over the world with it. Imagine, did you ever see a movie called Rain Man?
Yes.
So remember, Dustin Hoffman is an autistic savant, very smart, very able, but can't communicate with others, you know, can't put himself in the mental shoes of others. Imagine if the whole world was full of people like that. There'd be a lot of very smart individuals, but culture would not progress. You know, you wouldn't have phone calls, you wouldn't have lectures, you wouldn't have radio shows, and so on. And so that is a barrier which is worth breaching. And you would think that it should have happened multiple times during evolution, and it didn't. So the question is, why not? And the question is, you would, instead of saying that this is a good thing, I'm suggesting that the first time it happens to the first individual, it's actually not a great thing. So imagine if you're the first woman in Africa and ancient times, pre-human times, that got this ability. You can read the minds of others, right? You can, you should be able to dominate. You could tell lies. You could take over. You could fool everybody. Or imagine you're an elephant that's born with this ability. You could, win all your battles because you can fake out others because you can read their minds. So it should be a good thing. So if it's such a good thing, it should have just automatically or very quickly established itself, but it did not. So it turns out it's a terrible negative the first time. And I don't know if you, in reading the book, got the gist of why it's a terrible thing.
I did, but I'd like you to explain that to our listeners. And I think it involves the awareness of death, does it not?
Right. So imagine you're that woman who got theory of mind. And then she watches her sister die in childbirth, or watches her mate get eaten by a lion. Or you're that elephant, and you watch your friend getting killed in a fight with another elephant. All of a sudden, this wonderful ability to read the minds of others gets translated into something unexpected. You just watch the death of another mind, a mind you knew as a person, not just as another entity you could react with. And having watched that, the argument is, and this is something that's difficult to prove conclusively, it's a theoretical argument, that you now realize your own mortality. You not only realize that death is possible, you realize that you yourself are going to die. Now, as a mammal, you already have built-in, or a warm-blooded creature, you already have built-in fears of death. You know, every animal has a built-in automated fear of death. It doesn't know it, but it reacts to it. All of a sudden, this negative feeling becomes dominant. So what are you going to do? You're that woman, you say, I'm not having a child. You're that elephant, you say, I'm not fighting the bull elephant. I'm not getting involved. I'm just going to chill out and relax and survive. Well, you won't pass your genes on. And if you don't pass your genes on, that's the end of your line. So this would be the barrier, basically, to obtaining a full extended theory of mind. The secondary recognition of personal mortality and the fear that arises from that. A more technical term would be mortality salience. So now the argument is that this has been happening for the last 100 million years. Every once in a while, a crow, an elephant, a dolphin is born with this ability. And having observed the death of others, essentially goes into sort of an existential crisis and gives up. And so you never pass the you know, so let's say this involves hundreds of genes that have to come together. You're not going to pass that ability on to anyone else. And so the solution to the problem is something else that should be negative, which is denial. If you think about it, independent of theory of mind, if an animal denies reality, if you're a wildebeest and you decide to go check out the lions or anything else, any animal that denies reality too much is doomed. So that's a negative. So the argument is that you had these two negatives which occur randomly occasionally. One is denial of reality, which is a simpler way of putting it is suppressed fear, increased risk-taking, etc., which could happen in a group of individuals or in one individual. But that by itself is not a good thing eventually. It's going to get you. Meanwhile, you have some other individuals who have developed this extended theory of mind but who cannot tolerate the fear of death and other realities that they begin to realize, and they give up. So the argument we are making, Danny and I are making, is that this one time, in probably at the origin of modern humans, one group of individuals developed both theory of mind and reality denial, or suppression of fear or suppression of risk at the same time. And that combination gives you the magic a path through the evolutionary barrier. So is that making sense?
It is. It is indeed. You know, you mentioned a movie, and it kind of reminds me of another movie, a 1997 movie starring comedian Jim Carrey, and that film is Liar, Liar, and Carrey finds he can't get through a single day in society without the ability to lie. You know, the truth and nothing but the truth makes social life impossible. Is that different from what you're talking about?
No, it's an extension of that. Once you get the ability to read the minds of others, you can now carry out deception, right, of the others, and vice versa, as the group evolves that. But in fact, initially it should be a bit unstable. As I haven't seen that particular movie, I've heard about it, but you can imagine if everybody told lies all the time, that wouldn't work either, right? So it is kind of related. Of course, there's another kind of lie, which is self-deception, right? Once you develop this ability, now you can deceive yourself. And as my colleague Pascal Gagnier put it, if you can deceive yourself about your abilities, that actually might not be a bad mating strategy, especially for a male. So these things could have come together at the same time.
Well, you know, you talked about the negativity of the trait of denial. And for me, as I began with this idea of an imminent threat like climate change, I'm worried that human evolutionary biology may end with our extinction if we don't get this act together. Do you think this innate and necessary trait of denial is something that could be trained or overcome in the face of a grave danger?
Yes, it can. By the way, before we go to that, there's an important corollary, which is the other peculiar thing about humans is we have this unusual optimism bias. Sometimes it's called the Pollyanna hypothesis. We always look at the bright side of life, most of us, except those who are depressed, the few individuals. But what is optimism? Denial of reality. What is extreme optimism? Extreme denial of reality. So things like optimism, confidence, courage, bravery, you know, which we give a lot of positive kudos to, are variations on this theme. So one of the things that came along with denial is risk-taking. And sometimes the risk-taking pays off. My grandfather was a friend of Gandhi. And I always wondered growing up, what was this man thinking? He's going to take on the British Empire with nonviolence? What a ridiculous idea. But then he succeeds, pays the price, but then theory of mind transmits that idea to Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King and so on. So anyway, that's a bit of a segue, but it's related because the problem we have in all these things, climate change being the absolute worst kind of denial, is that we need to be optimistic. If you're not optimistic, we don't succeed. It's been shown over and over again. You know, I used to run track. If you don't believe you're going to win, you're not going to win. So how do you have optimism and realism and pessimism in the same brain at the same time? So with climate change, by the way, I should again give credit to Danny. He's writing this in 2004, 2005, before he died. I'm sorry, about 2006 probably. And he's writing at that time, effectively. You know, we can deny many things and get away with it, but the one thing we can never get away with is denying climate change, because everything else, be it national debt, healthcare, you know, disease, whatever, we can deny reality and eventually fix things. But there are two things we can't fix once they go wrong. One is nuclear holocaust, and we think we've contained that. We hope we have. And the other is climate change, because you can't go back. So on the one hand, we need to be realistic, and on the other hand, we need to be optimistic. And to specifically answer your question, the only solution is education. And unfortunately, that education has to come early on enough in someone's life for people to really, you know, appreciate it. I have friends in the climate change field and colleagues here at SIO, talk to them. And I keep telling them, use the word that you just used. We need fear. Maybe that's the only solution. But as you know, humans are generally optimistic and tend to ignore fear unless it really hits them in the face. So it's not an easy problem to solve.
It's what they call a wicked problem, I think.
That's right.
Well, you know, public knowledge of denial has been heavily influenced by the 1969 book On Death and Dying. That was by the Swiss psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And she, like you, worked with terminally ill patients. But Kubler-Ross suggested denial was a stage we can work through. I think you're talking about something very different. Am I right?
Yeah, this is not really... See, there's no true correct word for this. Denial is reality denial, ignoring, rationalizing. It's a combination of all these things. It's something that's built in. It's not a stage in a progression of thinking. It's just built into us as humans. You know, otherwise, after you had a near-death experience on the freeway, why would you go out and drive next day, right? Everything would shut down. So we need this. But when it comes to climate change, unfortunately, we only have one chance to do it right, and it's maybe already too late, but the question is, how do we communicate this to everyone else?
Our guest on Radio EcoShock is Ajit Varkey, professor of medicine at the University of California and co-author of the book Denial, Self-Deception, False Beliefs, and Origins of the Human Mind. Well, as you said, there's so many applications to the operation of denial. I'm thinking of smokers who keep smoking, or that one in three Americans is now obese, despite well-known medical risks of that. If denial is at the core of our ability to keep going, it also seems to be something that tobacco, food, and energy corporations can take advantage of for their profit. Ajit, from a doctor's perspective, are we being used precisely because denial can be triggered so easily?
Oh, absolutely. You can go further. It's only recently, because of social norms, that doctors stopped smoking. You know, I just looked it up. 40% of Chinese cardiologists smoke cigarettes. So it's very easy for anybody who wants to purvey denial of any kind. So in other words, the human mind just grabs at denial. Anything that, makes us feel a little bit better about something that we should be taking seriously, we'll grab at that. And so you're right that whether it be food or tobacco or any number of things, it is very easy to manipulate the human mind in the direction that one wants in this regard.
And how does this work? Do we draw a curtain? Do we move something to a special closet? Do we create comforting counter-arguments? Ajit Varkey, did you and Danny find anything about that?
No, so the question is, at the end of the day, to prove this hypothesis, you need, the standard dogma in science these days is don't make a hypothesis unless you can experimentally prove it. And this is a case where we cannot experimentally prove it overnight because we can't recreate evolution. But if I were to guess at what happened is, there's a book called The Optimism Bias by Tali Sherratt, who talks about the human optimism. And it turns out that deep in our brains is a place called the amygdala, where fear responses are handled in most animals and humans. And we have a way, it appears, of sending good news to the amygdala very fast and bad news very slowly. It's just a disconnect, which most other animals apparently don't have. So it could be that there are pathways in our frontal lobes and in our amygdala which may be discovered that are uniquely human. And by the way, that happens to be one of the areas where there are specific human changes that might explain this. Now, someday can that be used, pharmacologically or technically or in some way to interrupt that process? Yes, but then you're at a risk of losing your optimism. So it's a tricky problem. So obviously, like anything else in science, until we finally understand it, we won't be able to know what to do about it. So right now, unfortunately, we don't have the time, and we have to go with what we have, knowing that humans have this ability. And I'm sure I'm not an expert enough to comment further on that aspect, but I'm sure that, expert psychologists can probably come up with ways that would, have a greater effect. I mean, one thing I suggested to a colleague of mine who's a climate change person, I said, if you tell people about, 2-degree rises of temperature or global changes in hurricanes and all that, it sort of, they think about it and they don't bother to do anything. If you tell somebody that your local climate is going to change in a way that's going to affect you and your family and your livelihood in a major, major ways, that may have a bigger impact. So I'd like to imagine that if everybody in the world could look at the projection for climate in their own personal space, in the next 20 years, and such projections are possible, most people might be horrified to see what they see. So maybe, just maybe, that may induce sufficient fear that people may take it seriously.
Ajit, what is anthropogeny and why does it matter?
I stumbled into this field because I found the first difference between humans and chimpanzees. And anthropology is the study of humans. Anthropogeny is an old term which had fallen into disuse, which I've resurrected, which is the study of the origin of humans. In other words, where did we come from and how did we get here? And I think it sounds like a cliche, but, unless you know where you came from, you don't know where you're going, right? And in the case of humans, we have a broad picture of the things that happen in terms of fossil evidence and timing. We kind of know where we came from, etc. But the details are far from clear. And even less clear is how our mind evolved. So it seems to me that for every point of view, not just climate change, if we survive climate change, social engineering, I mean, how people deal with life and everything, we need to understand where we came from. So anthropogeny is sort of this broad quest using all possible lines of evidence to understand not just who we are, but how did we get here and where did we come from.
Well, I'll put a link in my EcoShock blog to CARTA, the Center for Academic Research and Training in Anthropogeny.
Yes, that'd be great.
Okay. Well, we're starting to run out of time, but, you know, I'm impressed with your whole career. I'd love to chat with you about your early discovery of that genetic difference between chimps and humans or your investigations into glycobiology. Do you have time to spend a couple of minutes just to explain to our listeners what glycans are and why you're looking into that?
Yeah, basically everybody's heard about DNA, RNA, and proteins, and maybe lipids and fats. And so you think that's what makes up a human. And sure, that is at the core of making up a living thing. But every single cell in nature, bar none, is covered with a dense and complex array of sugar chains. So if you looked at a cell, any cell in nature, it would not look like the planet Mars. It would look like the planet Earth, and everything that's green would be green and blue would be sugars. So this area of glycoscience or glycobiology, as it's sometimes called, got left out in the molecular biology revolution because it was too difficult. So I've characterized it as the dark matter of the biological universe. And so a few of us are sort of exploring this area. And it has, as you can imagine, given the ubiquity of these molecules, it has impact on just about every biological process and disease. But it's still not in the forefront of molecular and cellular biology. And so that's the other part of my career I've spent time on.
And now it's 4 years since the publication of the book Denial. Is it starting to advance into the general theory of human consciousness? Is it going somewhere?
No, there were two problems with the book, three problems actually. The first was that it's a book by a dead insect geneticist, which is Danny Brower, and a physician scientist who claimed to have found the answer, right? So we're the wrong people. The second was that I was not prepared to do this in the sense I was prepared mentally, but not in terms of my time constraints. And so I felt I had to get this book out, and I probably did a bit too hastily. And so it's not that I'd say I've written better things in my life. It's all the facts are there, but it's not your nice smooth read like it should have been. It wasn't fully edited the way it should have been and so on. And the third is by the time I was done doing it, I was so tired because I was falling behind on so many other things that I didn't really do what, you know, a book author is supposed to do, right? Go out on the road and give talks and go to bookstore signings and go on TV shows and so on. And so a lot of that was not done. So in that sense, this is, you know, the book did reasonably well, but it certainly didn't hit the limelight. And unfortunately for popular books, if you don't hit the limelight, you know, it can sit there for years before people find it. So I'd like to imagine that someday, you know, I'm hoping in my lifetime to follow up on it, but if I don't, then someday hopefully people will look back and say, oh, actually Brower and Varkey figured it out, but you'll never know. I won't be there to know that, so.
Well, in my opinion, it's definitely time to revive this book, Denial, Self-Deception, False Beliefs, and the Origins of the Human Mind. I'll put links for our listeners at where they can find it at ecoshock.org. And you can find links to our guests and this whole discussion in that same blog. Dr. Varkey, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. I really appreciate it.
Sure, it's my pleasure. I hope it has some effect.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Thanks to you as a listener, I have the privilege to talk with many very smart men and women around the world, but I'll seldom say that we've met with true genius as we did this time with Ajit Varkey. When I began to review his published scientific papers, I was astounded. There are hundreds, too many to count, going all the way back to 1977, over a dozen this year, Many are published in the top scientific journals in the world. Ajit Varkey has his own lab at the University of California, where he is surrounded by very bright young minds. You can find links to all this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Look for yourself. As you heard in this interview, I also find the kind of humility that can accompany true genius. Ajit Varkey knows what he doesn't know, and he has a sense of looking into difficult, dark places where humans have not been before. Dr. Varkey is not a climate scientist, but he's in touch with the field, and he knows this is one we must get right, and we can never go back if we don't. I hope you'll find and spread this interview through your own social media and friends. It explains so much about how denial flourishes all around us in so many ways. This interview was suggested to me by Rob Milkarski, who blogs at undenial.wordpress.com. Rob has prepared a short summary of Varkey and Brower's work. It's an excellent doorway. You can search for Undenial, Varkey, and Short to find it, or get the link in my EcoShock Show blog. Rob has also posted a longer summary of this theory of human denial, as written by Ajit Varkey and Danny Brower. Surf Rob's Undenial blog or get the link from my EcoShock Show blog. It's worth your effort to get this, to see how we manage to deny so many realities. It's a wonder we survive at all.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.